Good morning, everybody, and welcome into the last of the concurrent presentations. First of all, even though everybody's probably used to these presentations by now, I'll just remind everybody that the all of the questions are being recorded, and there's a microphone over on the left and the right of the room. Well, I'll introduce the main speaker this morning. Unfortunately, Mark can't actually be in the presentation this morning, so it's John Nichols doing the presentation this morning. John is a senior consultant with Towers Watson, based in Melbourne. John first joined Towers Watson in 1990. During his time with Towers Watson, he's travelled far and wide, working for 4 years in each of the US and Brazil, as well as working for extended periods in the UK and Asia. John's experience includes option pricing, asset liability modelling, financial reporting, mergers and acquisitions, and product development. John.
Okay, thanks, Paul. Morning. Topic today we're looking at is approaches to setting capital for investment guarantees, in particular looking at variable annuity style investment guarantees. I'm sure you're all aware APRA's currently looking at capital requirements for all business. Within the information that's been put out, there's been various little bits and pieces to set it out more specific or more slightly different requirements for variable annuity style products and guarantees. So that's really one of the sort of driving thoughts behind the idea for the presentation, to look at that in a bit of detail. So I'm going to investigate three main topics. First of all, just approaches to setting capital margins. As I talked about, APRA has set out some specific requirements around variable annuities. They're certainly not alone in doing so. So we'll have a look at what some other regulators, other countries are doing around capital requirements for the guarantees. We'll discuss a theoretically correct approach, emphasis on A. Obviously, there's probably an infinite number of such approaches, so we'll just focus on a particular, perhaps more of methodology as opposed to a particular approach. We'll also discuss shortcut approaches, which we do think play a very important role in terms of being able to understand and investigate capital and how it changes over time. Before I get into that, I do want to apologise. It's just myself presenting today. Isma's made a sort of significant contribution to development of the presentation. Currently, though, find yourself in Spain working on a project. So, unfortunately for you, just get my viewpoint today. As I mentioned, we know APRA's reviewing capital requirements here in Australia. Various other countries have specific requirements or considering specific requirements around variable annuities. Not necessarily all of them, but a number of them are presented up here. For example, the US have specific reserve capital requirements. Ireland, again, specific reserve and capital requirements came into effect just at the start of this year. Europe, Solvency II, obviously we all heard a lot about that and know that's going on. Solvency II itself, there's not specifically anything different identified for variable annuity investment guarantees. That said, there is a discussion paper that is starting to look at that, that came out, I think, late last year. So we'll look at a few points from that discussion paper. Elsewhere, Japan, China, Singapore have all started to look at and have if not requirements in place, starting to think about some consultation papers around these topics. So what we'll do is just go through a few slides looking at some of the more specific requirements from each of these countries. Go back to the beginning where VAs were first developed, US. The capital requirements refer to kind of C3 phase 2 capital. It's a principles-based requirement. The C3 refers to one of a number of elements of risk-based capital in the US, but the particular one for the emphasis on the variable annuities is the C3 requirement. I think this has been applied from around 2005, so it's been in place for a number of years now. The main element to the determination of capital is a stochastic calculation to work out the total asset requirement. Okay. And that's a weighted result between two different elements. There's a best efforts element and an adjusted element. The key difference between the two of those is that in the best efforts, you get to take credit for dynamic hedging strategy, whereas in the adjusted, you're not getting the credit for that hedging strategy. So the key difference is one takes account of your hedging, future hedging, the other doesn't. There's then a weighting between those two. So there's a factor to take into account the level of sophistication of the modelling of that hedge. In terms of the capital requirement here, you're actually allowed to take up to a sort of a 95% credit for the hedging strategy. They use the term clearly defined hedging strategy, and there's some particular requirements that you would have to have in place to be able to make that allowance for that dynamic hedge, such as you have to identify the specific risks you're hedging, the objectives of the hedge, risks you're not hedging, and a number of other requirements in order to be able to reflect that hedge. In addition to the total asset requirement that you develop using a stochastic model, there's a particular standard scenario minimum. So it's a single scenario that takes in a combination of some sort of point-in-time stresses and thereafter some defined levels of investment returns. So the final requirements, the greater the two, it's the stochastic result or the standard scenario minimum. For reserving and statutory reserving, this is a slightly more recent, come into play slightly more recently. I think applying from year's end for 2009 is what is referred to actuarial guideline 43. It's very similar structure to the reserve, to the capital requirement. Again, it's weighting between a best efforts result, taking into account the dynamic hedging, and an adjusted amount that doesn't take that into account. The formula is expressed slightly differently, but again, you have a factor E that takes into account the level of sophistication of the model. The more sophisticated, the greater the credit you get for the hedging. The more the capital or the reserve moves towards that, the best efforts result. A couple of parameters, E, not more than 0.7, not more than 0.3, if less than 12 months' experience. For those of you familiar with what APRA's put out, those numbers are probably familiar, and we'll come back to that. In both cases, using prudent estimate assumptions, so not best estimate, the non-investment assumptions, mortality, et cetera, take into account kind of at the prudent end of the distribution of outcomes, for example. Again, similar to the capital requirement, is another standard scenario minimum. So again, it's a stochastic amount or a standard scenario, if that's more, a different standard scenario to what's used for capital. In both cases, kind of the measure that you're really taking from the stochastic analysis is a conditional tail amount. So for reserving, you come up with distribution of outcomes and base it on the worst 30% of outcomes. For capital, it's the worst 10% of outcomes. So it's a CTE 90 type approach for capital. Ireland have set out requirements for reserving, risk governments for variable annuities. Yeah, there's a number of companies established in Ireland that are writing a reasonable amount of variable annuity business. So, Solvency II is applicable. Ireland's getting ahead of the game and has specific requirements that are already in place. I think they've just come in place at the start of the year from 1 January 2011. Again, it's a capital and reserves, so the total amount is a grade of two elements, conditional tail expectation based on the stochastic modelling, or a kind of reserve element with stresses applied at a point in time. You can use an equivalent value at risk measure, and unlike in the US, for example, no policy may be specifically treated as an asset. Similar to the US, though, there are you can take into account the dynamic hedging, but there are limitations around that again. Another point to note is that in terms of, in analysing the capital outcomes, you're looking over the lifetime of the business, and that's a specific requirement in terms of the Ireland requirement. In Europe, the Committee of European Insurance Occupational Pensions Supervisor put out a consultation paper, a draft report on variable annuities. Committee goes by a different acronym now, being the European Insurance and Occupational Pensions Authority. It looked at how supervision work both under a Solvency I and Solvency II framework. At some specific points or conclusions in relation to Solvency II. First of all, the basic Solvency II framework is adequate for the technical provisions. So for just measuring the basic liability that you would start with in terms of measuring capital, the basic provisions are okay. However, the standard formula approach that's set out, the conclusion is it's not sufficient for capital requirements in relation to VAs. That said, though, the principles for internal models would be applicable or suitable for VAs. A couple of other points under the Solvency II structure, regulators can require companies to use an internal model, if not for all the business, for parts of the business. The draft report suggests that regulators really should consider requiring internal models for VAs. A couple more points around Solvency II. The first point is just setting out the basic measure, 99.5% value at risk measure over kind of a 1 year time frame. The current structure does allow a different time frame to be considered, and for VAs, it's really recommended that be the case. And you are able to reflect dynamic hedges again, but subject to qualitative, quantitative limitations. I haven't seen any specific quantitative limitations as yet being suggested around that, but certainly pointing in that direction. It's just a consultation paper. Exactly where it will end up remains to be seen. Japan has solvency regulations in place. They're changing with effect from March 2002. For variable annuities, you'll be able to use either a normative approach or an alternative methodology. The normative approach is in effect looking at how much you need under a particular stress. That may be using standard or non-standard parameters. But it can't be less than would come from the standard parameters. For older business, there is a much simpler formula that's in effect grandfathered. Alternative approach is in effect again an internal model type approach. The information I've seen doesn't have a lot of guidance around that, but companies are able to develop their own approach, file that with the regulator, and once applied, continue to do that unless particular conditions arise, such as, you know, back testing has failed or a significant change in their risk management models. There's a number of criteria to be able to use the internal model approach, particularly around the risk management. Regardless of whether you're using, you know, the normative approach or the internal model type approach, you are allowed to take credit for dynamic hedging. That said, again, you know, there's criteria under which you're allowed to do so. You know, we won't go into the detail around that. China, getting in the act. There's no VAs currently in China, but you know, they are starting to think about it and have set out some interim rules for variable annuity insurance management. Doesn't go as far as looking at capital, but certainly starting to look at the risk management and reserving requirements. You know, some particular points here, if we look at what they're putting out around reserving, again, it's a conditional tail expectation approach, understanding the distribution of outcomes and basing reserving on the 30% of the worst outcomes. The non-investment assumptions, best estimate, plus a margin. Similar to some of the other bases, for example, in Ireland, US, there's also a deterministic stress scenario as a minimum. So, you know, the result you'd be taking is a grade of from your stochastic analysis or a stress scenario result. There's no credit for hedging in the reserve calculations. You know, that's not too much of an issue, really. The issue would be if you're setting up the capital requirements, can you get credit for the reserving? Final one to take a look at, Singapore. Document has a really long name, but really it's about, again, about use of internal models for nonlinear payout guarantees. In this case, looking at capital, the result is a CTE 95 approach, so looking at the worst 5% of those results. Looking at a result, in this case, with a net, without margins for adverse deviation, and you know, taking the greater of those results. A couple of other statements that it includes around, you know, swaps can be recognised as an asset on the balance sheet, but no credit for the swap when calculating the liability or capital for mismatch risk. You think, you know, there's perhaps still a little way to go in Singapore, and I think, you know, the authority over there recognises that, and you know, particularly around, you know, how you can hedge the risk and reflect that for the capital requirements. So, you know, before we move on, look a bit what APRA's proposed in terms of Australia, you know, there's probably some sort of key themes we can pick up coming out of what the different countries have put out. First of all, it's emphasis on stochastic analysis for determining that result. Generally, you're going to be looking over a longer time frame, you know, not looking at just a variance over a one-year time frame. They at least allow partially take credit for the hedging, although generally there's going to be conditions applied around that, so, you know, qualitative, quantitative limits. Very often, in addition to doing the, you know, the stochastic result, there's a particular stress or scenario that's applied as a minimum, as over and above what comes out of the stochastic model. Turn out and have a quick look at what APRA has put out in their proposals for the under the new capital regime. The basic structure is, or the basic premise is really the 99.5% probability insurer will be able to absorb unexpected shocks and losses over a one-year period and continue to be able to meet the obligations at the end of that period. So in effect, it's, you know, a one-year time frame. Evaluate risk type measure with a 99.5% level of sufficiency. Capital charge determine difference between prudent adjusted liability and, you know, probably some simple formulas we're familiar with, you know, adjusted prudent liabilities taking into account termination value minimums. In relation to variable annuity guarantees, just highlight a couple of statements from the first discussion paper that came out. And really, yeah, the first one, proposed standard asset risk capital charge will not adequately cater for special features of variable annuities. Going on, it's likely stochastic modelling would be required instead of scenario-based calculations used for other types of products. And in terms of doing the stochastic modelling, you can take into account both the asset risk and insurance risk simultaneously. In the response paper that came out a couple of weeks ago, in effect, this position's been maintained. There's no real change to that position being indicated. What it has said, though, you know, the stochastic modelling is not going to be mandated. You know, it's certainly highly recommended, but you know, there is some option to do that. That said, and you know, we'd certainly highly encourage companies to do it, given you know, through that stochastic field modelling, you really develop a deep understanding of how the guarantees work, what are the product dynamics, and so forth. And we'll illustrate a little bit of that shortly. The proposal for variable annuity sets capital weighting between, again, a best efforts measure and an adjusted measure. In turn, determining best efforts capital requirement, you're able to take into account your dynamic hedging program or how you're hedging the risk. The adjusted measure does not take that into account. The factor that kind of weights between them then takes into account the level of sophistication of your modelling. You know, the more accurate, the more sophisticated, the more you can weight towards the best efforts result. That said, you can't take more than 70% credit for the dynamic hedge or a lower amount if you're new to it and have less than 12 months' experience. Should be somewhat familiar. It's exactly the sort of approach that's being set out for reserving in terms of the actuarial guideline 43 in the US. If we can sort of look to generalise, you know, if we think about principle-based capital standards, we can summarise these probably according to some sort of key parameters. First of all, risk measure definition. Yeah. What's the time horizon we're looking to protect over? Risk measure, you know, is it a value at risk type measure? Conditional tail expectation, you know, how are we going to define that? Third element will cost the top line, the risk appetite. What's the level of sufficiency we're going to aim for? What are the risks covered? You know, obviously, investment risk, insurance risk, mortality, expense risk, and so forth. And choice of model. You know, a number of choices, for example, you know, stochastic model, stress-based analysis or results, and in some cases, it may just be a factor-based approach. An impact measure. You know, what is it we're going to look at and quantify in terms of changing in relation to those risk factors? You know, that would typically be you know, a liability type measure. And the final element is you know, how do we piece it all together? You know, what's the dependent structure we assume between the different risk factors? You know, typically, you know, correlation matrices, or are you building that into the you know, the model, for example. So, yeah, if we think back, you know, probably you know, any sort of principle-based capital-type measure, you know, we can summarise according to these factors. Yeah, obviously, I'm not going to go back through all of them, but yeah, as a starting point, yeah, if we just think about the basic measurement model that under the APRA's proposed capital requirements, yeah, it's a one-year time frame, value at risk type measure with a 99.5%. Sufficiency level, the various risk factors that have been identified for asset risk, insurance risk, operational risk. For the most part, it's a stress-based model. You know, apply different stresses and revalue the liability under those different stresses. Operational risk, much fall into a slightly different category, being a factor-based allowance. Risk-bearing value, I've indicated here, adjusted liability. You know, we'll look at how that changes, and you know, the movement will give us a distribution of outcomes that we can take into account in setting the level of capital. I maybe could have put in here that just the risk-free BEL, for example, in terms of determining kind of the underlying level of capital, and then take into account termination value minimum is kind of another layer possibly. And the final element, the aggregation approach here, there's a number of different correlation matrices that have been set out. First of all, aggregating up different elements of insurance risk, asset risk, and then at the top level, then combining those. So I'm not going to go back through and look at the others, but that just using the APRA one as an example. And then sort of ask the question then, APRA's really looking for something different in terms of variable annuities. So what might that look at? In terms of time horizon, in effect, really identifying that 1 year is not going to be enough. The next slide, we'll look at the reason for that. Risk measure. There's not necessarily a clear winner there. Most of the international standards are heading down a sort of conditional tail expectation type approach. Risk appetite, there's quite a bit of variation. Some levels, 95%, 90%. In terms of if you're looking over the lifetime of the guarantee, I don't think APRA has specified anything specific around that. So I'm not about to do so in their place, but what might you think about in terms of defining a particular risk appetite? In the absence of having a mandated requirement, I guess the first place I might start to look at, well, what's the risk appetite of the company that you're setting the capital for? And that could have an influence. Ultimately, you're going to have a need a requirement that APRA will be satisfied with. Perhaps that's something you should be discussing with APRA as you're working through and developing the process. At the end of the day, though, it's also a combination of getting the appropriate risk appetite to line up with the measure that's chosen, whether it's a VAR or CTE type approach. The risk factors, again, they're various, but still the same ones, particularly the investment in insurance risk elements. In this case, choice of model that's really being indicated is in terms of investment risk, the stochastic model, and the stresses in terms of non-investment risk. So still applying prudent estimate assumptions or however you express it, best estimate plus a margin in terms of mortality and other non-investment assumptions. For the risk-bearing value, I think similar to the basic standard that I talked about, we could look at the risk-free best estimate liability. Over the top of that, we could still overlay requirements for termination value minimums. But in terms of particularly the stochastic analysis, we can look at how's that risk-free best estimate liability going to change as investment conditions change through our stochastic modelling. Dependent structure, will now be a combination of factors. In effect, for the economic type factors, the dependent structure would be built into the model for the development of the scenario. So, relationship between equity returns, fixed interest returns, and so forth, part of the model calibration and built into the scenarios. For the other elements, such as insurance risk, can be more of a factor. Based approach. Just want to come back to risk appetite for a second. The other thing I want to emphasise is that appropriate risk appetite could depend on the nature of the guarantee. For example, if I have a one-year guarantee, would really want to have, if I'm using a VAR risk, a 99.5% level of sufficiency. it would come back, all my risk is gone within the 1 year, so I should really be coming back something consistent with the basic principle that's been set out. As I extend out into sort of longer term guarantees, if I keep at a 99.5% level of sufficiency under VAR measure, it's going to become a very strong requirement. If I have a portfolio with a very long guarantee, I would want to take into account or be able to take into account a lower level of sufficiency to account for that longer risk. Head of the slide here, why at least partially stochastic? I guess another way to look at that question is, why isn't a one-year time frame sufficient? The answer, risk is going to be present throughout the runoff of the portfolio. Under other types of products, the insurer has more control over the asset mix. So you have the potential to be able to move to a matched investment position over that one-year time frame. For VAs, part of the product design is you're passing that control over the asset mix to the investor. They're going to stay invested in risky assets. So these risks are not going to go away. So in terms of setting capital requirements, it should be appropriate to take them into account, and just looking over a one-year time frame is not going to capture all the risk. It's not going to capture path dependence. It's not going to pick up all the effects of policyholder behaviour and so forth. So I certainly would agree 1 year isn't sufficient. We need to look over the lifetime of the guarantees, and stochastic modelling is a tool that enables us to do that. In terms of stochastic models for VA guarantees, they are complex. We're talking about nested stochastic approaches, and we'll look quickly at an example in a minute. Shortcut approaches have a role to play, whether you have stress scenario testing, look at an example scenario selection techniques, replicating portfolios. Methods that can approximate the outcome of our stochastic model, but do it in a much quicker way, and certainly have a role to play. Seen in some of the other examples, they form a floor for regulatory capital. They can be perhaps be used to help in performing interim valuations. Fast close, as I come up to year end, I might run a full model in the lead up, and then look to use some of those shortcut methods in terms of determining what my liability or capital should be given economic conditions at the actual close. Obviously, sensitivity analysis. Another point I maybe put up there, communication. You can use the scenario to try and explain to people, what that capital outcome actually represents. For example, it might be consistent with a particular fall in equity prices or a combination of equity and fixed interest movements. We're going to move on and look at quickly just an example illustrating use of a stochastic model and a particular shortcut approach. Before we do that, just put up a few points about probably most common product type currently available in Australia. These are the kind of lifetime income guarantees, lifetime guarantee minimum withdrawal benefits. Three products currently available in this category from AXA, Macquarie and OnePath, providing a lifetime guarantee. So might be 4 or 5% of the money you put in, you can take out as an income for the rest of your lifetime. So it's providing longevity cover. Obviously there's variations as you get older, the level of benefit that's guaranteed might increase, permit different investment strategies. Charges, obviously they're going to go up, the riskier the investments that are permitted. They all include annual sort of ratchet feature. Fund value is performing well, the level of the guarantee will step up over time. There are some additional features. You know, for example, you know, they all offer a single or joint life. You can have a joint life feature for an additional charge, for example. I think, you know, for example, the Macquarie product also includes a guaranteed death benefit, if I'm not mistaken. So just highlighting that really as a background to using for illustration purposes, just a sample GMWB product, guaranteeing 5% for life, taking into account an annual ratchet. For simplification here, you know, just assume male age 65, and taking into account, in terms of the analysis, dynamic lapse, you know, the policyholder behaviour will change in the analysis as investment conditions change. We've then, in terms of evaluating capital, run an stochastic model. So what we mean by that, we're running 1,000 real-world scenarios to see how we expect things will evolve over time. But in terms of analysing, you know, the reserve and capital requirements at it, or hedging requirements at each point in time, as we go through that those real-world scenarios, each month we're running nested risk-neutral calculations in order to work out what is the reserve, the sensitivity of the reserve, and to implement a dynamic hedge position. In terms of the hedge, you know, we've just used a delta hedge and a parallel row hedge. And then for each scenario, we've worked out, well, how much wood we need in order to fund any future or the maximum future strain. And, you know, we've looked at that, what would be over a 1 year or over a 35-year horizon. If we do that, yeah, we can come up for a distribution of the required capital. So on the chart here, the kind of the more the blue colour represents the unhedged results climbing up over time, and also the lighter colour, the hedged results for each of the 1,000 real-world scenarios that have been run. Kind of the red line at the top would be what we would have got if we just applied the parameters from the what APRA proposed in terms of what we call quiz one here. And, yeah, that's a result that takes into account the hedging. So through that and modelled, yeah, we can get, you know, a full distribution for what we expect the capital to be. Obviously, you know, quiz one is quite a pessimistic result. Yeah, we've looked at the proposed changes that have come out a couple of weeks ago. In fact, that would drop down to around 5% level, so yeah, back down around here within the tail of the distribution that we've come up with. So in the first chart there, we're looking at 1 year time horizon, and yeah, we do see some benefit of hedging over on the in the tail of the distribution. We've done similar information here now, but now we look out over a 35-year horizon. Yeah. The scale is quite a bit different, so you know, these are much higher than obviously what we had on the previous slide, looking at the 1 year horizon. What we perhaps didn't expect here is that generally hedging hasn't given us much benefit over the longer horizon, and yeah, we'll talk a little bit more about that shortly.
Yeah,
the red line is again, so that's the original quiz one again. So yeah, that's still at the 8% level. You know, quiz two, 5% be down around this level now. So in effect, we're seeing much more above those quiz results. So that's the capital requirements are much higher. This slide presents a, you know, slightly different picture, still present exactly the same in terms of the unhedged result, but in terms of the hedged now, rather than ordering them, you know, we kind of lined up the result of the hedged scenario with the unhedged result. So kind of the left-hand end, you know, the hedged result is at the higher end, so the other is the cost of hedging coming through over there. At the right-hand side, you know, we see more the benefit of the hedging coming through in the more adverse scenarios. If we extend the time horizon out to 35 years, you know, the benefit of hedging isn't as clear. And you know, in effect, what we're really seeing is a result of, you know, where on each scenario is the actual capital requirement coming from. In terms of the unhedged result, it's coming up much earlier in the scenarios. Then over time, you know, the cost of the hedging is building up, and generally in many of the scenarios, over time, you know, the hedge result in this case is turning out to be worse as those hedging costs are accumulating, and in this case we're coming up with a higher requirement, but at a much later time. Yeah, wasn't fully in line with our expectations. So yeah, we did go back to the model, and yeah, everything was working as expected. Interesting result. So you may, through going through the analysis, come up with some unexpected results. We've also looked at what are some of the factors that affect the capital requirement. This chart here is looking at just the unhedged results and the annualised equity return up to the point at which the capital point was reached. So, if the minimum accumulated surplus occurred after 10 years, we've looked at the annualised return up to that point in time when that minimum accumulated surplus occurred. Not a strong relationship, but in terms of the unhedged result, the worse the performance, the higher the capital requirement. If we look at the hedged result, there's less of a relation, even less, much less of a relationship. Not surprising, given we're hedging the equity risk through the delta hedge. What gives stronger results, for example, the model does incorporate changes in implied volatility, and that has quite a strong influence, or a much stronger influence, on the capital outcomes here in the unhedged case. There's definitely, I would say, a positive trend as implied volatility increases. Perhaps less clear, but still somewhat present, would be that we're still seeing a relationship in terms of hedge capital and the level of implied volatility. That should be the case. We're not hedging against that risk, so we should see that similarity in results between the unhedged and hedged capital. Interest rates. These are long-term guarantees. While we are hedging against interest rate, we're just using a parallel shift. The model has much more complexity in the movement of interest rates. So here in terms of the unhedged capital, we do have kind of a strong, or another relationship. More capital you need, the lower the interest rates. No real surprise there. The hedge result, less clear. We are hedging that risk to some extent, but less clear relationship over a 35-year time horizon. I think part of the reason it's less clear, as I talked about, just the cost of the hedging accumulating over time, confusing the picture. That said, what we have then done is looked at potential shortcut method to cut down the number of scenarios you might need to run. And using a relative present value distance method, it's a method that looks to oversample the tail. By taking into account, based on our scenarios, how implied volatility will change, or the impact on a put option, trying to select a smaller sample of scenarios that we can use to estimate the overall distribution that would have come from running the full sample of scenarios. There is kind of more detail about that reference later in the pack, but we won't put that up. So what we can then find using this methodology, and what we're presenting here, is the unhedged capital distribution, presented slightly different, but sort of a cumulative distribution and how it sets up in the tail. It's kind of the smoother blue line. The red line, slightly more noisy now, is using a representative scenario method. Rather than running 1,000 scenarios, we've run just 100 scenarios, applied weights that come out of the process, and come up with a method that, in this case, is reasonably reproducing a good part of that distribution we've got from running a full 1,000 scenarios. So, you know, depending on needs, you know, this method, you know, we may be able to cut our run times by, you know, down from, you know, 1,000 scenarios down to 100 scenarios, but still being able to come up with, you know, estimates of capital requirements. So, yeah, the chart here is looking over a one-year horizon, unhedged result. Similar, you know, this is a hedged result. You know. We'll go over a 35-year time horizon, again, you know, the unhedged result, and the fitted result, you know, coming up reasonably well. Perhaps slightly more difference over the 35-year horizon using the hedge result. So, yeah, potentially, yeah, we haven't done as part of putting the presentation together. Yeah, we could investigate, yeah, are there other factors that we could use to derive distance measures that would improve that fit? Or maybe rather than 100, yeah, maybe it's 120, 130 scenarios, yeah, we might need to include, you know, to improve that result. Next few slides look something different, but yeah, it's looking at a different measure. So yeah, the first measure was picking scenarios based on implied volatility. You know, similar charts looking at using a put option, impact on a put option to select those scenarios. Again, though, yeah, we can, you know, in, you know, many of the cases, coming up with a reasonable fit. Does break, you know, break down a little bit in terms of the 35-year time horizon. So, yeah, a little bit more work required, but, yeah, there are methods out there that, you know, can reduce run times significantly, and it may be of use in terms of interim valuations and so forth, as we discussed. So, yeah, open up for questions, but the key emphasis, I mean, you know, stochastic modelling, you know, gives you a lot of information about the dynamic natures of the guarantees. It'll allow you to investigate, what are the drivers of capital, you know, is it changing implied volatility, interest rates and so forth. While that's the case, you know, shortcut methods, you know, absolutely are going to play an important role over time. You know, some of the other sessions have looked at other methods, such as replicating portfolios, for example, as well. So, in practice, I think the bag of tools you really need is going to be a mixture, you know, full stochastic model plus other techniques that improve runtime in terms of managing the business. So, pass over for questions.
Josh Corrigan from Milliman. Thanks, John, for an interesting presentation. I certainly agree with you that I think the future requires a combination of both, you know, full nested stochastic and simplified approaches, simply because the nested stochastic approach is quite onerous. In all the years that I've been doing these calculations, I've seen, I guess, increased reductions in capital from hedging relative to some of the numbers that you've presented today. So I'm just trying to understand some of the key assumptions that you've used in that. In particular, I think the frequency of the roll forward is quite key, because those capital numbers are going to be very much driven by gap events and other assumptions, such as differences between implied volatility assumptions that you've used in your pricing basis versus the realised volatility assumptions in your scenarios. So I was wondering if you could just comment on those few things.
Definitely agree. First of all, you know, in terms of kind of the time or aspect, in terms of the illustration here, you assume the monthly sort of time step. In reality, you know, hedging is likely to perform more frequently, daily. More frequently than that. The impact of hedging, I would agree, is understated in terms of this particular result. In terms of implied volatility, what's driving that for more is, I think, how that level of volatility is assumed to change
at the time, given that that risk, we haven't assumed any sort of hedging of that risk. The model we've used in terms of this case, you know, is a fairly simplistic model, which is projecting a level in implied volatility and relating that to emerging actual volatility, you know, through each of the scenarios. You know, so you know, if there's a big increase or decrease in equity returns, you know, that will have an impact on the level of the implied volatility. The other point is around just the level of volatility in pricing versus what's assuming the pricing versus the model. To some extent here, pricing has been based on, we just really used a charge consistent with what's in the market, whereas the implied volatility is more representative sort of current local. So we're in terms of the capital calculations, we're starting if that volatility exact number, the 20-25 cent range, that may be different from what actually coming in the prices for, which might be lower.
Kevin here, Warport. John, there seems to be, I'm not quite sure if I believe it, but there seems to be a wealth of information of an understanding of how the market and economic risks will unfold. But I also see in these products as a really important risk is relates to the customer behaviour, and there seems to be a dearth of information about how that's actually looked at and analysed and understood. I just wonder if you have any comments and views about how customer behaviours should be analysed and put into these stochastic processes.
Customer behaviour is very important. Exactly how customers behave, they may behave rationally. Some will not. And there is a dearth of information that's available. Over time, companies should be able to build up based on their own experience, views as to how that experience is emerging over time. It really will come down to trying to track given economic conditions, what are levels of lapse rates? How do they change as levels of the value of the guarantee change over time? So guarantee is well in the money, are you actually observing reductions in lapse rates, for example, monitoring that over time, developing models or revising the parameters that you assume you can take into account of that information as it emerges. I think there's probably a lot of commercial sensitivity around what that experience is, and that certainly contributes to the kind of data information that people are putting out there in the public domain. Obviously, discuss with consultants to see what happens in different countries with companies. Identify necessarily specific experience, but we can help give advice as to what typical behaviour might look like that you can then use as a starting point.
Richard Land, and up front I've got to confess that my understanding of hedging arrangements is probably not quite up to your speed, but my question is, I've had experience in doing stochastic modelling for these type of guarantees without hedging, so I understand how you do all your stochastic runs and you find out the cost and you take the present values under various scenarios and average them, etc. What I don't quite understand is how you overlay the hedging in that modelling, and maybe if you could just give a brief description. And specifically, I've always thought that there was a risk in a dynamic hedging process where it's short-term hedging, so you're always continually re-weighting and rebalancing your hedge. I've always seen it as a risk that in the adverse scenario where you've got the GFC, for example, the cost of your hedging program is just going to explode, and basically the derivative protection is not available. So if you could give a basic on how you overlay the hedging in that, and what, how that risk is taken into account? Is it just the implied volatility?
In terms of kind of the specific of some of the calculation is at any point in time you evaluate, for example, what is the economic liability given the economic conditions of that scenario. So the particular set of where is the account value, what are your interest rate structure at that point in time, and what's your assumption as to implied volatility. We can use that to come up with a kind of central estimate of what that liability is. You can investigate how does that liability change in terms of impact of the change in your equity amount, change in the interest amount, and then using the equity return as an example, what is the kind of the delta of that, and execute a futures trade to sort of offset that risk. We can build that and actually include that that instrument in the model. So as we step forward, the next time so we can reevaluate the liability, we can also reevaluate how's the value of that future move, or how's the value of that swap move in terms of the interest rate risk. They won't be the same, and that's why we're not fully eliminating that risk. In terms of do things break down, yes they will, it's not necessarily something that's easy to sort of build into the model, but there are other elements in terms of what's actually used in terms of the capital requirements. For example, in what Apple's proposing, they're not going to let you take full credit for that hedging. And some of the factors behind that are that there are these risks that are not going to be fully reflected in any of the models that is done.
I'm afraid, as everybody's heard, time's essentially up. I'm not sure if there's any more burning questions. We might have time for one last one. But I think, compiling that, I think everybody would agree it was a very interesting walk into the world of variable annuities and also for these specific examples. So if everybody can join me in thanking John for an interesting presentation.